It is just about a minute before 10 o'clock. This is Community Radio, WERU-FM. Support for public affairs programming on WERU comes from Coastal Enterprises Incorporated, CEI, a private nonprofit community development organization offering financing and technical assistance to small businesses, social service facilities, and affordable housing projects throughout Maine. 882-7552. Stay tuned for Alternative Currents with Bella Johnson.
Good morning. You're listening to Alternative Currents with host Bella Johnson. Welcome to the March edition of the show. Today we're going to be speaking to Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of The Dance and also The Invitation. To dance, from her book jacket, to live in a way that is consistent with our longing, is to discover a gift that we can give ourselves again and again over a lifetime. To dance, alone or with others, is to be who we truly are as we fulfill our soul's desires. To do this, we must learn how to let go and slow down, returning to the sacred emptiness where we encounter our true self. Practical, inspiring, and profoundly illuminating, the dance is an invitation to discover a place of connection, serenity, and joy that is uniquely our own. Oriah Mountain Dreamer is a visionary teacher and writer and author of the best-selling The Invitation. She gives speeches and leads workshops, ceremonies, and retreats throughout the United States and Canada. And with that, I'd like to invite Oriah to speak with us today, and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for being there. Your reputation precedes you. As I was wandering around the station getting ready for the show, the engineer asked me who I was going to interview, and I mentioned your name, and a young woman said, "Oh, you're going to interview her." She said a friend gave me a poem that she wrote, mm-hmm. and I think she was quoting from your prelude, or your, yes, to the book, and she was very impressed, so welcome.
Thank you.
What if the question is not why I am so infrequently the person I really want to be, but why do I so infrequently want to be the person I really am? This is off the front of your book. Can you answer that question? not in 10 words or less.
I can, actually. And I think that the woman in my dream who posed the question answered it also. And she said, because we don't believe that we'll be enough. And that's why we really shy away from the idea that the task is simply to become all of who we are. We really feel like that won't be enough. It won't contribute enough. It won't change what needs to be changed enough. It simply won't be enough to ensure our safety and well-being and that of the people that we love. And so we are constantly trying to be more than we are.
So what is the dance, Oriah? What is the invitation to that dance that you're speaking to readers about?
Well, the invitation, in a sense, was really a focus on the longing itself. I have enormous faith in our longing as human beings. I think that, if we go below the kind of daily needs and wants and desires we have, many of which are perfectly legitimate and important to us, but when we go even below those to the essence of what we long for the same things. We long for a kind of peace and deep rest, and we long for real intimacy, a real showing up with passion in our lives. So I have enormous faith that if we can connect with that longing, we can really move into a deeper life. Now, living that longing is what the dance is about, how you bring your daily actions into a consistency with that longing that's really at the deepest part of yourself.
Yes, a quote from the book. There's not need for self-improvement. We live our deepest soul's desires not by intending to change who we are, but by intending to be who we are. Mm-hmm. Sounds very humanistic, actually.
Well, it's also very contrary, I'm afraid, to what most of us have breathed in this culture. The notion of original sin is alive and well, even though we live in a predominantly secular culture and those terms aren't used as much as they might have once been used. We still are really, I think, given an enormous message from everything from, you know, well-meaning spiritual teachers and healers to advertisers, which says, on one level or another, there's something deeply wrong with who you are, deeply flawed in some basic way, and that will have to be transformed. And so we get on this endless treadmill of self-transformation, self-improvement, which I think in many ways just exhausts us.
Well, it's also, yes, in traditional psychotherapy, the same kind of thing, labeling you as something other than.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was saying it's very humanistic, the branch of humanistic psychology.
Yes.
Goes,
no, that's
yes,
true.
Mm-hmm. That we
that
become more of who we are.
Yes. And that we are by nature growth-oriented and wanting to expand and be more deeply who we are. That's part of our nature. I mean, the dance really offers the hypothesis, if you will, that we are by nature compassionate and capable of living fully present. That is by our nature. We are innately that. So a lot of the dance is about getting out of the way of that essential nature.
Yes, again, a quote from your book. Having compassion does not mean indiscriminately accepting or going along with others' actions regardless of the consequences to us or the world.
Mm-hmm.
It is about being able to say no where we need to without putting the other out of our hearts. I really like that. I like that whole flavor to your book about just being constantly challenged to accept but not put someone out of our hearts.
Yes, and that's a big one, you know, and it comes up a lot with women who will say to me, well, you know, what happens when somebody at work or in my home is doing this, you know, something that clearly sort of violates other people's rights to be or whatnot? And, you know, I say, let's not confuse compassion with accepting all behavior. But compassion recognizes when someone's behaving badly that this is another human being behaving badly, perhaps in a different way, but in probably driven by many of the same fears that I have. It is another myself behaving badly in the moment. And that capacity, learning that capacity to say no, to draw a boundary, while at the same time not making the other something less than human, you know, not making them the jerk or whatever, you know, label we want to put on it. That's really the task of expanding, of letting that essential nature that we are, that compassion, hold that other person at the same time as we may be in a position where we have to say no.
Well, it's unconditional love, isn't it, really? Seeing the
yes.
divinity in a person despite what the personality is doing to obstruct it.
Mm-hmm. And yet, the difficulty with the word love, which I think is critically important, is that it's also connected with feeling. And compassion is not a feeling. I think people get confused about that because we expect when we feel compassion, I mean, sometimes we do feel a kind of warm, fuzzy feeling, and sometimes we don't. And in a sense, the warm, fuzzy feeling is not necessary. If I can keep in my consciousness how you are another myself, I may or may not in this moment have a warm, fuzzy feeling towards you. We may not, you know, click in a particular way. But that doesn't mean I can't see you in my own consciousness as another myself.
Right. Oh. How did you come up with your name?
My name was given to me by, Araya was given to me by a circle that I'd seen in my dreams for many, many years, and a very long time ago when I was ill with chronic fatigue. And I woke up one morning from a dream and said to my husband at the time, I think that part of getting well is changing my name to Araya. And he said, okay. And I woke up the next day and said, no, I can't do it. It's too flaky. It's too weird. And then the next week said, no, I have to do it. The poor man didn't know, you know, what to call me. And Mountain Dreamer was a name given to me by a Native American elder with whom I apprenticed for 8 years. And he gave it to me the first time he met me and said that it was a medicine name, which means it's something that tells you about what your work in the world is. And he said, this is a name that means someone who likes to find and push the edge and can help others do the same.
Yeah. I similarly had a spiritual awakening about 15 years ago and changed my name. And it was the same kind of thing, totally flaky compared to what my birth name was. So I found it interesting. There's a lot.
Well, that would explain why you're one of the few interviews who didn't say to me, so that's not your real name, is it? Because I always
say, is your real name.
Exactly. I would say, oh, it's a real name, all right. It's just not my birth name.
That's right. Yeah. The name you chose. In fact, I've said to my kids, it's like, if you ever want to change your name, I did the best I could.
But right.
You want to change that. It's perfectly all right with me.
The other thing about this is I admit to sharing the same prejudice in this culture around names.
You did in the book.
And I say this marvelous in the dance. When somebody comes up and says to me, hi, my name's Ophelia Morning Glory, I think flaky.
Yeah, I know.
Which is really cheeky for a woman walking around using the name Araya Mountain Dreamer. But there you are.
Yeah, well, my sister changed her name from Cheryl to Sunshine, and I said, well, that's really hard to swallow, but you know, I'm going to work with that as best I can. So I'm totally with you on that.
I think it's very gutsy.
Yes, your whole ability to kind of take yourself lightly in this book is very affirming for women who tend to take themselves, I think, way too seriously. I think that it took a lot of courage for you to write in the straightforward, very self-revealing manner that you did. Again, we are speaking with Araya Mountain Dreamer, author of The Dance, currently out and published by Harper, San Francisco. Yes, so anyway, I thought that was, it took a lot of guts to write that, frankly.
Well, it's funny what you say about not taking ourselves seriously, because it's such an odd paradox, where on the one hand, to live who we are, we need to take seriously that this is the life we've got. You know, this is our opportunity to do that and to not fritter it away by being basically, you know, asleep, by going through the motions every day. On the other hand, that can really get very heavy and very judgmental and immobilized by taking ourselves too seriously, you know. And it really helps to have a sense of humor about your own humanness. It helps a lot to just see, you know, what to get up the next day and take another crack at it all.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I'm just going to kind of go through some of my notes here and give you a random suggestion so that you can speak about that. The changing versus being, I think we covered already, but it would be nice to kind of flesh that out a little bit more. No need for self-improvement. We live our deepest soul's desire, not by intending to change who we are, but by intending to be who we are. I don't want to beat this to death, but I do want to expand on it.
It really is the core of the book, though, which says, you know, if we believe that there is something essentially wrong with us, then the task becomes to try and change that, to try and transform it. And we are surrounded by seminars and books and a variety of teachers who say, you know, come here and these are the 8 steps to change who you are forever, or the 5 steps or whatever. If we believe that the essence of who we are, our essential core, is in fact good, is in fact compassionate and capable of being fully present, then the task is to let that essential core unfold. It's not to change it. And that's a very different task. And I use the poem by Hafez, that writes, you know, how did the rose ever open its heart and give to this world all of its beauty? It felt the encouragement of light against its being. Otherwise, we all remain too frightened. And that tells us, it talks about how we unfold, how we learn if we believe our task is to unfold, is to receive the people and the places and the practices that really do help us unfold in our lives, to recognize them and fully receive them. And that's what helps us unfold.
But that's hard work.
Oh, it is work, but it's not suffering. And there is a difference. You know?
I mean, I'm with you on it, but I'm just saying it's, you know, doing the work that
it
we came here to do, doing the work of soul is work.
Yeah.
And if we listen instead to a seminar that says if you take these steps, you will have abundance, you will have joy, you will have what you want, I think it's often easier for people to go that way and say, okay, just tell me what to do, even when it comes to God, essentially, or creator.
Yeah.
Just tell me what to do. I'll do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hear in that people's real hunger and willingness to do whatever it takes, but their lack of faith in themselves that they'll be able to find it. And that's not to say we can't learn things from good spiritual practices and traditions around us and find a way of developing a practice. I'm very big on people having some kind of daily practice that brings them each day to an opportunity to really experience who and what they are. And that if you don't cultivate that when things are going reasonably well, when you're in a crisis, is no time to try and develop a practice, you know.
But we are a crisis-driven culture, largely,
well,
definitely. You know,
I think what happens is there's a combination of of us having been through a number of crises, but also if we believe that our essential nature is deeply flawed, we think that we don't change unless we are forced to by crisis.
Right.
And so we become what I call sink or swimmers. And so even when one's not happening, we will tend to throw ourselves into a situation that generates a crisis because we truly believe that that's where we do what we need to do. And that's, again, based on that very core belief that there's something essentially wrong with us.
No, I totally agree with you. I think one of the hardest things to do is to sit with oneself. And you spoke mm-hmm. about this when, towards the... I told you I had 100 markers in
yes.
this book, and I'm having a hard time going through to finding that one. But when you found that place in the wilderness that
yeah.
you went to, whether that place in the wilderness is indeed a geographical place or whether that's a place within the wilderness of the self, I think that's one of the hardest things to do. And I forced myself, like you did at one point, to do that actually for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just unbelievable to have to listen to all the inner voices, to have to listen to all of what was going on inside
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm. And that's when you find that the noise and the lack of rest that brings is really more inside than outside.
Oh, definitely.
You know, I mean, I once did a 22-day vision quest where I was in the wilderness for 22 days, and I couldn't believe the racket all in my own head, of course. You know, here I am in the beautiful, you know, quiet solitude, and the amount of chatter in my head was unbelievable.
Yeah.
So it is about even just being with that without judgment and watching it, you know, not getting caught up in it, but watching it. I was speaking the other night, though, and a woman said, okay, so when I'm really frightened, let's say, I sit down and I think, okay, I'm just supposed to be with the fear. And she said, I sit there and I feel like I'm going to explode with pain. And I think, okay, now what? What am I doing? This is it? I'm just supposed to be here and be in agony, you know? Of course, in some sense, she probably wasn't really being with it. She was sitting down and going, okay, but, you know, resisting it at the same time. I love... Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk who talks about, you know, when you're enraged or fearful, it's like a screaming baby, and you don't walk away or yell at the baby. You pick the baby up and, you know, try to see what's wrong and just be with it. And if we could be that way with our own fear, our own anger, but it's not always easy. And again, it helps if you develop a practice of doing that with the little tiny things.
Right.
You know, so that the first time you're trying to do that isn't when someone close to you is dying and you're terrified. That's no place to start. That's too hard. You just can't, you know, that your level of pain goes so high that you have to move away from it. And human beings are very, you know, innovative. We can use just about anything to move away from pain. You know, I mean, there's the usual kind of drugs, alcohol, overwork. But, you know, we can use spiritual paths and methods, going to 1,000 conferences and workshops, you name it. We can use just about anything to move away from what's at the center of our own lives that's uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah. Going to a place on earth that speaks to us is not enough. We have to be able to listen with the very cells of our being to truly receive what the place has to offer us. It is. It is the work. And like you say, I mean, to wait until one is in crisis, to be able to just take little chunks of that and really fully be with the self, and to hear all of those voices of self-negation and doubt that come in, that are bound to come in,
yeah,
because we've been so well conditioned to them.
You know, every time I've gone out to spend time alone, and, you know, I've done preparation and made arrangements for my children or, you know, whatever, all kinds of things. As I'm going out, I always have this voice in my head that says, this is crazy. You really need is a rest, a vacation. Why aren't you going somewhere nice instead of sitting out here, you know, this whole thing? And what I have learned is not to engage with that voice, simply to say, oh, I know, maybe it's crazy, but I'm here now. I'm going to do it anyway, you know? So not to sort of, you know, kind of resist or engage, but just kind of keep on walking in the process. And that seems to work.
I'm trying to hear you. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Apparently,
okay.
A headphone I had just went bad or something.
Ah, okay.
Lost you for a moment.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's
I mean
okay.
to leave you hanging there. Yes, being able to find, to accept anywhere we are. I mean, you know the old saying, wherever you go, there you are.
That's right. Yeah.
To be able to go there and be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's no getting away from that. You know, I had a friend who's just moved 3,000 miles away to be in an environment that's less hectic than the big city. And she has, and she's glad of that. But what she's, of course, discovered is that most of the hecticness she's carrying with her. And so there she is, 3,000 miles away, and running around, you know, at a sort of maniacal pace. And now the environment she's in will support her slowing down perhaps more than being in the large city, but she's still going to have to deal with what is it that internally that keeps her moving so quickly, trying to stay one step ahead of something.
Oh, it'll be a transition. I moved from, when I was 18, moved from Los Angeles, California, to rural Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And then quickly move back again, and then quickly move back again.
Right.
You know, I just, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Wherever you go, there you are.
That's
but it
right.
did take quite a number of years to slow down, but it does help, I think, in that way to have the external world mirror that new vision for your internal world that you wish to acquire at some point. You spoke briefly about addictions. I'd like you to get into that if you can.
Mm-hmm.
Your senses and feelings about how addictions prevent us from, again, reaching that ground within the self.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we all use different things to numb out, to move away from the things that feel too frightening in ourselves or in the world. And we can use just about anything, as I said. You know, we can use TV or reading or drugs or alcohol, sleep, sex, you know, work. Work is my personal favorite.
Yeah, mine too.
And at a certain point, we're using whatever that is to move away from the pain, and then at a certain point where it crosses in from being a bad habit to being addiction, it uses us. It has us. We don't have it. And at that place, it really isn't something that's within the control of our immediate will. If with your will, you can stop doing that action that you do all the time to numb out, then you have a bad habit. You're not addicted. I have learned an enormous amount from people who are recovering addicts who I've met and who are in my life, some of the very best people I know who are recovering alcoholics or drug addicts. And my experience of them is that they tend to be very strong-willed people. And that's part of the trouble they got into was being strong-willed and having enormous faith in their will. They really felt that they could always handle whatever it was they were using to, you know, move away. And that really the process of recovery was realizing that they had encountered something over which they no longer had control with their will. I call it in the dance, you know, the wall, the place you hit the wall, the place you cannot go beyond by the strength of your own will. For me, that's how it is at times with my own drivenness, my own wanting to do more and move faster. And, you know, it's partly just the recognition that we don't control a lot, and at moments we don't control even that, you know, sort of internal desire to have whatever it is we've been using to numb out. And we really need to draw on something larger than ourselves at that point. If we're, and that larger than ourselves may be a loving community, you know, what I call the mystery, what other people would call God, acts in all kinds of different ways. So, you know, some people will say, well, you know, I have no sense of a presence that is larger than myself, like God. And I'll say, do you not have that even in terms of community? And they'll kind of go, well, yeah, times in community. So there are different ways to draw on something larger, but mostly it's the learning of humility, I think, of saying, I can't just change this with my will.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. And I mean it, you know, the recovering addicts I know are amongst the most strong-willed people I have met.
Oh, I've lived among them, and I can say that that's absolutely true.
I mean, I am, and I would have to say that having had chronic fatigue is part of what brought me to the place of needed humility.
Yeah.
And it took me a couple of years of being very ill to face that I couldn't just change this illness with my will. In fact, it was my will that was getting me into trouble, in a sense, you know, because it had was keeping me moving and going and trying and working all of the time.
I know these are not my words, but something comes to me as you're speaking of that, almost as though this is part of the existential fear of death. Mm-hmm. I mean, just in a lesser form of saying that we fight from the beginning of our lives to resist against that which is inevitable.
And in fact, for, you know, and we all use different things, whether we're addicts or not, to numb out at times, you know. And usually it develops into an addiction because it feels like the pain we're trying to avoid. It really, whether we know this differently rationally or not, but it feels like it will kill us. It feels like if we don't, you know, eat one more cupcake, have one more drink, work until we're ready to drop to go into bed, whatever it is we're using, that what will catch up with us will in fact annihilate us. That's not true, and you may even know in your head it's not true, but that's what it feels like to the smaller self. And that what it's trying to avoid is death.
Yeah. Surrender.
Yeah.
To that something larger that that we're speaking of.
You know, and there's some truth in it. There's some truth in the business about the death of it, because
small death.
What it's talking about is the death of the smaller self that we are highly invested in. You know, what we have presented to the world as, you know, who we are by what we do and various labels and whatnot. And in fact, when we hit that place, there is a death of that smaller self, and it will fight to try and maintain its existence.
But what's on the other side?
Oh, freedom. Because that smaller self lives in constant fear. And when you're in fear, you forget. You get a kind of amnesia of the heart, I call it in the dance. You know, you forget who and what you are, and that you're made of the same stuff that everything else is made of. And so on some essential level, no real harm can come to you. The only freedom we have, really, of a real kind, is freedom from fear. And that smaller self lives an enormous amount of fear and consequently causes for itself and others enormous amounts of suffering. So, you know, while it feels like death, and in some sense it is, what's on the other side is a freedom, the freedom of knowing what you're really made of and that you really do belong. And so no real harm can come to the essence of who you are.
Yeah, another quote from your book, sooner or later, when we surrender what we cannot control, we have to hold still and let the demons we have been running from catch us. There is no greater terror, but there can be no greater liberation than to face those demons held in the arms of your own compassionate nature and that which is larger than yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, I picture them like little black dogs nipping at my heels.
Yeah.
You know, I do have a very clear image of being a child riding a bicycle down the street, you know, when little dogs would race out and nip at you, and the absolute terror of that as a child, you know, and that's what it's like. I mean, that's what it feels like, that they're gonna get you.
And I like that you also, again, in that wonderful way that you have of just really owning, just being so frank with people about your own life, you know, that it's not over for you. It's something
do
every day. It's something that I do every day.
Yeah.
I mean, you clear the path, and then the next challenge comes up, and that's the nature of existence.
And you get to, I mean, you know, at one point there was a suggestion that the read line for the book could be something like, discover the rewards of living with integrity. And I said, no, it sounds like you're collecting mileage plus points here. And the reward of trying to live with integrity is that you get to wake up tomorrow and try and do it again.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, that's not the only reward. There is a kind of peace and joy that comes from living from the center of who you are. But it's not a done deal. I do think it becomes easier. You know, the first time you stop and let those little demons internally catch up with you, it feels like death. The second time, it feels like death, but part of you's had the experience of knowing that it won't kill you. And so you're able to relax into it. I kind of equate it with the difference between the birth of my first child and the birth of my second child. You know, the first time, I'm going on other people's word that this will really, all this agony and labor will result in a child. It seems very theoretical in the middle of labor. And the second time, it may hurt no less, but there's another kind of faith born of experience that, in fact, this is all worth the effort, and there will, in fact, be new life at the other side of it.
Yeah.
And that makes it easier to just stay in the present.
You speak, too, about how easy it is to look around for somebody to blame, and it's just so classic with human behavior.
Yeah.
You know, it's either me or it's you.
Right, and it must be you.
And it's got to be you, because I can't face that in myself,
right.
You know, basically.
You know, and people come up to me all the time after I speak, and they'll say, well, you know, I'm really willing to do this, but I can't get my partner to do it,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Or I can't get the people at work to do it. And I just laugh. You know, the point is, you know, of course you can't. You don't have any control over these other people. all you have control over, and even that's iffy at moments, is yourself, and you make the best choices you can. And but it's so easy to say, you know, things would be better if only my partner, you know, would do this or would do that, or the people at work, if only they understood this or that. And you know, my father used to say all the time, people do the best they can with what they have to work with. And lately I've been thinking a lot about this, about the choice to basically approach the world from that perspective. I can't prove to you that people do the best that they can. But if you choose to assume that, it changes how you see people when they're not doing too well, and how you see yourself when you're not doing too well. You know, Dad used to say, people do the best they can with what they have to work with, and some days you have more to work with than others. So it allows us to suspend judgment about why we or other people aren't doing so well today, you know, and are being blind or being judgmental or being angry or whatnot, you know. And that makes a difference.
And that's the dance.
It is.
We are going to be taking a short break. I want to remind listeners that we are speaking today with Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of both The Invitation and The Dance, but more particularly today speaking with her on her book, The Dance, published by Harper San Francisco. We will be taking a short break. You're listening to Alternative Currents on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor. This is Bella Johnson, your host. We'll be back in a few. Sting break here on Alternative Currents. You are listening to on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor, a monthly program with voices that challenge our essential nature to make itself known more fully to us. Speaking today to Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of The Dance, published by Harper San Francisco. And listeners, we can have call-ins today if you want to give us a call and talk with Oriah Mountain Dreamer. She is speaking to us live today. You can call the station at either 469-0500 or toll-free 866-625-WERU or 9378. I'll probably only remind you of this once or twice. And do feel free at any point to give a call and interrupt our conversation to have a bit of your own. Welcome back, Araya.
Thank you.
I love this quote. In fact, I may use it in a future book of mine. Forgiveness is the name of love practiced among people who love poorly. The hard truth is that all of us love poorly. We need to forgive and be forgiven every day, every hour, unceasingly. That is the great work of love among the fellowship of the weak that is the human family. Lovely.
That's Henry Nouwen, who was a wonderful Catholic priest who worked in a community. He's from the States, but he worked in a community up here in Canada worked with people, I believe, who had addictions. And I think it's true, you know, that continual need to forgive self and others for failing to be the perfection that we sometimes think we want to be.
Are there many practices really ask us to be, don't you think?
Yes. You know, and one of the things I say is that one of the first steps in this is that we have to sacrifice perfection for wholeness. That perfection really is the enemy of wholeness. It will pick at what is whole and good and complete until it's just, you know, a shambles kind of thing. Always picking at, you know, what could have been done more. The old phrase, better is the enemy of best. And so to somehow accept our humanness, you know, our really complete humanness, and at the same time knowing at the core of that is this, and that part of that humanness is this core of essential goodness of who we are.
You know, it's funny, with the people I know who are most challenged by addictions are the people that try the hardest to be perfect.
Yeah.
They just vacillate between no good and perfection.
Yeah.
And there seems to be no middle ground, which would be the ground that I believe you're addressing in this
yeah.
book.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I see it in myself, in my addictiveness to overwork, you know, that it becomes a kind of all or nothing proposition. And human beings, you know, can't live there. We really can't. We live in the muddy middle.
Okay. You speak of the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Being mindful that we really can't control. We need to respect that there is a certain amount of mystery that we need to live with.
Mm-hmm.
How do you encourage people to more fully accept that kind of groundlessness in Pema Chodron's words?
Mm-hmm. You know, part of this comes out of my own aversion to some of what comes out of what I call New Age fundamentalism. I use the term New Age in two ways. One, to sort of be an umbrella term for all of the spiritual exploration in the last 25 years that's been incredibly expansive and has included, you know, Buddhism and yoga and, you know, all different forms of spirituality outside the kind of traditional mosque and church and synagogue. And certainly I've been part of that. The other way I use it, though, is this kind of core set of beliefs at the center of what I would call New Age fundamentalism. And one of the very core beliefs in that is that everything that happens to you had to happen for you to learn what you needed to learn. And so it attributes, particularly in difficult situations, you know, where something horrible has happened, that something was orchestrating just that horrible thing to happen so you could learn what you need to learn from it. My difficulty with this is I just think we can't know that this is true. And my experience of the presence of what is larger than me as a very kind of ground of being is that it would not orchestrate my having been raped as a young woman to learn things. Now, I did learn certain things from that, and they were incredibly valuable lessons. I wouldn't wish that way of learning on anyone. So part of this has to do with expanding our ability to live with not knowing why things happen the way they do. Which, of course, makes things very uncertain. You don't know. If I can't say to you, you know, this happened because it had to happen, and it had to happen because I wasn't getting the message, then you don't know that it couldn't happen in your life. And that's the reality, is the uncertainty. So can we live with those kinds of basic uncertainties in a human life and still choose life, not start to close down a little from fear of the pain that might come. That's really the challenge. And I think we learn to do that by learning to live with the smaller anxieties first. You know, I'm wonderful that you mentioned Pema Chodron. I love her material. And her practice of Tonglen that she teaches, where you sit with the feelings you normally try and get away with, she recommends get away from. She highly recommends you start with small things, which I, of course, completely ignored when I started the practice.
You and me both.
And then just totally blew myself out of the water, you know, started with trying to sit with some pain around my son's struggle that was just agony. So, I mean, when it comes to dealing with the big questions, you know, sort of sitting with why, say, the death of a child occurs or whatnot, and living with the unknownness of that, it helps a lot if you have practiced on a regular basis just sitting with the not knowing on the thousands of little small things every day. Now, I also want to say here, I'm not eradicating the kind of magic that can at times run through our lives, you know, where we're in the right place at the right time and everything lines up as being very real. And it's as much of a mystery to me as, you know, the times when things just, you know, when bad things happen to good people. So we can, you know, savor when that magic runs through our lives. But I think it's dangerous to sort of start making, you know, absolute statements about things like that. Like, this had to happen, and it, you know, for me to learn certain things. You know, I was very ill when I was younger, and I see how I learned invaluable lessons from that. And it's one of the cases where I'm not sure that anything but illness would have taught me that. But I, you know, the illness came out of my own drivenness. I don't believe that the hand of God reached down and made me ill so I would learn those lessons.
Right.
But we can learn, we can find meaning in everything that happens in our life. In other words, we can bring to it our own willingness to learn that gives us meaning. But that's different than saying that that's why it happened.
Yeah. Well, you talk about these small steps, and there's really just nothing out there that's encouraging us to do that. I mean, I think of the Nike slogan, you know, just do it, take action, just do it, you know, get out there, grab the world by the short hairs, you know, and it's really, really tough to gear ourselves down to saying we will make any progress at all if we just take these small steps. And pain sometimes is, this just the pain of living is so overwhelming that how can these small steps lead to that break from that never-ending kind of agony that many people experience during, I think, process of transformation.
Yeah.
I mean, to use a word that, you know, you're probably not, that isn't your favorite word, but I do think it's transformation, just little pieces of it at a time, and it's a personal transformation.
Well, I think what it is it's an alleviation of suffering. And I think at the bottom of all of our longing, what we really long for is to alleviate suffering in our own lives and in the world. You know, I was in New York City last November and was asked to do a healing circle down near Ground Zero and met with various groups of people. And people repeatedly said to me, you know, they were still obviously in great shock and grief, and they said, what should we do? And I repeatedly said, I don't know. But this I do know. I have enormous faith that if we could sit still together with everything that has happened, and it is happening inside ourselves and around us, that the wisdom for right action will find us. And people were starving to sit still, to find a way to do that. And as one woman said, you know, I want so badly to stop, but I feel this enormous pressure from everyone saying we have to get back to normal. And she said, I just want to stop. Now, often it is in this culture, we don't know how to stop. You know, we don't have a practice that helps us stop, and everything around us is moving so quickly. We entrain ourselves to that momentum in order to survive. It's like you don't drive on a freeway 20 miles an hour because it's dangerous. So you tend to speed up to match what's around you in order not to get mowed over. So you really have to put some time and energy into finding places and people and ways to stop together and to slow down and just be with it. It doesn't just happen, not in this culture.
No. So what is, seeing as the mind is what runs on and causes all of our self-doubts and agonies and problems in so many cases, what does one do with the mind? What do you recommend people do with what is going on in that mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, at first, I mean, the biggest thing I recommend is that people just watch it. Just be aware. Just, you know, as frequently as possible in the day, take a couple of breaths, bring yourself right to the present moment, and watch what your mind does, because your mind is rarely in the present moment. Your mind is usually rehashing the conversation you just had with someone and what you wish you'd said, or anticipating what's going to happen later in the day and can I fit in this and, you know, whatever is going on. So the mind is rarely right in this moment right now. The mind also in this culture gets overly preoccupied with what's the best thing to do. So, you know, all of the various kinds of genuine seeking about, you know, what's the work I should be doing in the world? How can, you know, should I change my job? Should I leave here? You know, on one level, our important self-exploration, and another level doesn't matter. I think, you know, the group of teachers and elders I've worked with, every time I've gone to them over the years, I mean, it's amazing how often I've done this and said, you know, should I write another book? Should I teach this? Should I speak here? You know, whatever. And they will say the same thing every time. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you never write another book, if you never speak again. It doesn't matter what you do, but how you do whatever you choose to do. Now, that's a tough one because we are so focused on what in this culture, that certain jobs are more important than others, that I will do more good in the world if I write another book than if I just run the corner store. And in fact, what they're saying is, if I could be more fully present with everybody who came into the corner store, I would be contributing more to the world than if I wrote another book that I thought was important. Now, I have personal likes and dislikes. I love to write. So for me, writing helps me do that in a way that's mindful and present. But boy, we are so hooked into being sure that it's just got to find the right thing, you know, or the right person to tell us what to do, or the right way. And really, it's about how we do whatever we do.
Yeah.
And whether we can just be here.
Well, I think people don't want to miss the opportunity to fulfill their soul's destiny, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, in the work that I do with people as a medical intuitive, is constantly listen to people saying, I'm running out of time, I'm running out of time.
Right.
You know, I don't have enough time to do what I came here to do. My experience is, yes, indeed you do, but yours is what?
yeah. And I mean, you can feel the sort of panic around that, right? And the kind of way we drive ourselves because of it. You know, I'm not getting it. And the fact is, oh, God, there's a wonderful Rumi poem that says, what you are looking for is nearer than the big vein in your neck.
Hmm.
And the last line of that poem says, the more skill you use, the farther you'll be from what your deepest love wants. So, in fact, whatever it is we're here to do, which I think has to do with how we live, not what we do, is available to us right now, to everyone, and it's only available in the present moment.
Right.
So there's no kind of, you know, there are journeys we take in getting there, but that's, you know, our way of circling around, in a sense, if we could just drop into it. It's right there.
Again, listeners, I'd like to remind you that we are speaking with Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of The Dance, and we have about 15 minutes left of the show. If you do wish to call in, please do so at 469-0500 or 866-625-9378. If you have questions, comments, or want to get involved in the conversation, please feel free to do so. Armor, you say, we are afraid of all that's holding, well, we are afraid all that is holding us together is the armor we put on to survive what is hard. I think it's really important to get past that, some may call the ego, and others may just call, you know, armoring the self, that fear that keeps us from truly reaching out to others and reaching to the self.
And what it keeps us from doing is really receiving that light of encouragement, that warmth that would help us unfold. You know, I've seen myself and other people do this, where we take ourselves to the places where we feel that's most likely to happen, where we could unfold, whether that be out into the wilderness or to a certain workshop or whatnot. But the trouble is, we don't really take it in. You know, the armoring, the kind of defenses against allowing ourselves to unfold are so heavy duty that the thing is right there that would help and encourage us, and we can't really receive it. You can't receive it with that armoring on.
What do you think causes people to do that other than normal traumas of life?
Yeah, I think, you know, fear. Fear and that belief that if you let me unfold, what you're going to find out is something horrible,
yeah,
that the core of who I really am.
Yeah.
That's right.
Right.
I've seen this a lot with people going out to spend time in the wilderness, you know, alone. And you know, we all sort of anticipate being afraid of bears and things like that. But what I've seen more frequently is underneath that is this core sort of terror that if they sit alone in the bush with nobody there to see, so it's not like they're going to be judged by anyone else, that they're not going to find that there's anyone that they even want to be with sitting out there. That the core of who they are is basically not a good thing. So, you know, don't go asking me to take my armor off and let you shine your light of encouragement on me and unfold. We're both going to be sorry because what's underneath there isn't good, you know. So we have very little faith in that essential nature of who we are.
And don't you think, recognizing that about ourselves, if we can get to that place, that's part of that compassion, mm-hmm, in being able to see that maybe that another person doesn't know that they're terrified that nothing's there.
Absolutely.
But we do.
Absolutely. And that helps a lot to keep us from making the harsh judgments on others who may really truly be behaving badly, you know, that it's fear. They're absolutely terrified. I think of this a lot when I hear of somebody, you know, doing something that really brings harm to those that they love, and I think, wow, they must just be absolutely terrified.
Mm-hmm. You know? There's one other element to this book that I don't want to leave without mentioning, and that is what you call loving from a distance.
Mm.
When we see people, as you say, behaving badly, mm-hmm, even and most especially people very close to us, being able to realize that or to get to that place where you never, you mentioned this also, you never really truly lose that love for that person, mm-hmm, as the distance and the time grows. Can you speak on that a little bit, the loving from a distance?
Yeah, the line in the dance, the prose poem is, let us risk remembering that we never stop silently loving those we once loved out loud. We may be with someone and it may not be appropriate for us to be with them any longer. It may be unsafe for us to be there. There may be lots of reasons. But I think one of the freeing things I've found as I get older is to realize that I don't stop loving the people I loved. We don't earn love, and I think this is one of the difficulties. We believe that we do. One of the reasons we work so hard is because we believe we have to earn our place and we have to earn love. You can't earn love. And that means you also can't unearn it. Now, you may lose someone's respect or trust, or they may lose yours, but in terms of that love, that's there. And I find it very liberating to be able to say, you know, that of friends who I may no longer have contact with or my ex-husband, that to recognize the love that's there, but to know that that doesn't translate into we're going to be buddies, we're necessarily even going to see each other, you know. I think what happens sometimes where there's great hurt in a relationship is that we try to convince ourselves that there's no love there, that we no longer love this person, as a way of sort of self-preserving, you know. And the difficulty with that is there's a piece of us that just doesn't buy that. And then we label that piece, you know, masochistic or, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's never masochistic to love another. It may be unwise to put ourselves in proximity to that person, but that doesn't mean that we have to stop loving them and that we can't do that from almost a kind of neutral place that has a distance to it, if that's what's appropriate.
Yeah.
And I think that can be very liberating.
Well, again, that not putting them out of the heart,
mm-hmm,
that's got to be one of the hardest things.
You know, I have a dear friend who knows the Dalai Lama quite well, and at one point he brought a woman to the Dalai Lama whose mother was, and always had been, very cruel to her, quite horrendously so, and she told some of her story to the Dalai Lama, and he said to her, it's important to resolve your relationship with your this-life mother, but you don't have to put yourself in a position of being on the receiving end of this cruelty. But what you can do each day is simply hold her in your heart and keep yourself out of harm's way at the same time. So it was this lovely way of saying, you know, this is your mother. You know, sit each day and hold her in your heart. Surround her with a sense of love. But you don't have to put yourself over there where she keeps hitting you over the head. That's not your obligation. That's not what loving her is about. It is not about letting her abuse you, as in this case she was.
So setting healthy boundaries around people, but at the same time being able to extend past that, past that perceived wall. Araya, are you doing any kind of speaking engagements on the East Coast that anybody might be interested in, or what are you doing with your work these days?
Well, from now until the end of June, I'm actually doing a fair bit of traveling, although it's not on the East Coast. I am doing something next week in Washington, but that's a sort of in-house thing at a company. And my whole speaking schedule is actually on my website at www.oriamountaindreamer.com. Oriya being O-R-I-A-H. So folks can always find my speaking schedule on the website. In June, I stopped traveling to write for another year. I always knew that this would be a trilogy, and so I'll be writing the third book of the series that's called The Call. And then starting in September 2003 again, I'll be doing some more traveling.
Any words that you wish to say in closing, or just kind of summing up what we've spoken about with the dance and just how that extends itself to people, the invitation of the dance, as it were.
Well, you know, when I wrote the little piece, The Prelude, it really is my way of kind of trying to dip my toe in the water of some of these ideas, is to say, what if, in my own mind, you know? And so what I, you know, suggest to people that they just consider, you know, what if it doesn't really matter what you do, but only how you do it, you know? What if the question isn't, you know, why am I so infrequently the person I want to be, but why do I so infrequently want to be the person I really am? What if we don't need to change? What if we really do just need to unfold? You know, and saying what if for me is a way of getting around my argumentative little mind, you know, that wants to point out, yes, but what about this and that? And just sitting with what it feels like if this was true, if it was true that who you are is really enough and all you need to do is to unfold, what if that's true? What if your responsibility is to be happy, and that's the way you will make the greatest contribution to the world? And just letting that lead you into a deeper place inside.
Yes. I'm looking through these little what ifs. Have you got them all?
Yeah. Oh, no, I have. Well, I didn't go through all of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just my way of sort of feeling the shift. You know, what if, to say what if is just a sort of thing, just entertain, don't buy it, just entertain the idea. You know, one of the ones I like most is, what if who you essentially are right now is all you are ever going to be?
Yeah, that's great.
And to be with a sense of both terror and relief about that, you know, because we're hoping we'll turn into somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Again, I think it is that integrity of strong-willed people saying, "Well, just tell me what to do." You know, I'm not enough. Is the unspoken word. I'm not enough. So just tell me what it is I need to do to activate my soul's journey, or to live out my purpose.
Yeah.
What is our service to humanity in that sense? Since we are community radio, in closing, your feelings about work one does, transformational or journeying work with oneself, and how we have a responsibility or don't have a responsibility to bring that into community, bring that self-action into community.
Well, we will, whether we do it consciously or not, because the nature of reality is that of interconnectedness and interbeing. We know this. An angry person enters the room, and we pick up that. Being around people who are complaining all the time versus people who are pointing out what the blessings are in the day has a profound effect on us, you know? So we live in community. There's no way out of that. And given the interbeingness of reality, how we are affects that. Gandhi said you have to be the change you want to see in the world. And he also said, you know, he had three enemies. One was the British Empire, one was the Indian people, but the most difficult enemy was Gandhi himself. That the real struggle is with being that change you want to see in the world. If you want the world to be full of more peace, then the work is to become that peace, because it will ripple out from you, just the way, you know, rage and dissatisfaction ripples out from us. So, you know, there are conscious ways to be in community and in terms of taking conscious action for change that I think are important. But the truth is, whether we're doing that or not, we are always contributing to and forming the community by how we are with ourselves.
Perfect. I would like to thank you so much for being our guest today.
My pleasure.
Alternative Currents. Wish you the best. In closing, this has been a conversation with Oriah Mountain Dreamer, author of The Dance, published by Harper San Francisco and available everywhere. This is Bella Johnson, and we are speaking to you from Community Radio, WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 in Bangor. Stay tuned and present for tomorrow when fundraising begins once again. Please consider contributing your heart and your pocketbook to Community Radio so that we may continue presenting programs like this. Thank you, and we'll be speaking with you next month.